We had an introduction, formulated by our professional services, but we also received a personal introduction, and I'm going to use that. It's something that Dr. Watkins himself wrote. We asked him to tell a little bit about himself. He said, "I grew up on a farm where I learned the value of hard work. I have six younger siblings. We all had the blessing of working together on the farm. I finished my bachelor's degree in business finance with a minor in Spanish in 1984 and returned to the family farm as the business manager. I finally pursued my lifelong goal of becoming a doctor at the University of Nebraska Medical Center in Omaha in 1991. I completed my residency training at St. Mark's Family Medicine Residency in Salt Lake City in 1998 and moved to St. George to begin practice. As a family medicine doctor, I actually delivered nine babies at the old hospital before giving up family medicine to practice sleep medicine full time. I became board certified in sleep medicine in 2002. During the first 9 years of my sleep medicine practice, I was self-employed. I had the opportunity in 2009 to become employed as a physician with Intermountain and medical director of the Sleep Disorders Clinic. I am married to my wonderful wife of 42 and a half years, Paula. I have three sons, eight grandchildren. We've heard you're pretty fond of them. My most passionate hobby is exploring trails with Paula in our side-by-side. We rode ATVs for many years, but have now graduated to a side-by-side. My favorite trail would be in either Boulder Mountain or Monroe Mountain. Dr. Watkins, thank you for coming.
And your That you want to circulate around there.
We want a double rule.
Right. The whole purpose of this today is for us to express our concerns and questions to our sleep expert, Dr. Watkins. You have suggestions in front of you if you haven't been able to think of any. If you have a question or a concern, please raise your hand. I will bring you the mic. Please don't speak until I bring you the mic, okay? Who's first?
My question is, when you can't sleep, should you get out of bed or should you stay in bed and hope for better things?
That's a really good question. And I'll preface that by saying I hate PowerPoint presentations, which is why I don't bring them with me, because I can read the slides as well as the presenter and usually faster. And if I prepare something, then I may not be able to address this particular question. Okay? So, the answer to that question, the simple, easy answer is get out of bed and go do something else. So, sleep hygiene, this term that's been coined for what do we do to prepare to go to sleep, would tell us if you're not asleep within 30 minutes, get out of bed, go do something quiet, relaxing, non-light if possible, not your tablet, computer, phone, whatever. Whatever you go to do should be in dim light, something non-stimulating, so you don't want to pull out your favorite novel and then you can't put it down until 6 o'clock in the morning kind of thing. Pull out the Bible and open Isaiah or something. That'll put any of us asleep. Okay? And then when you're sleepy, you go back to bed. So we learn maladaptive habits over our lifetime. So this will come as a shock maybe to all of you, but for most of us, insomnia is a learned behavior. Oh my goodness, yes. See, that is like, wait, no, I don't do this to myself. Generally, and it's not 100%. Okay, but generally, something happens in our life 30 years ago. Maybe it's the marriage of one of our children. So it doesn't have to be a big, huge negative thing. It could be a really positive thing, but it causes so much stress and anxiety. Then we don't sleep well. So then we start incorporating some bad habits that perpetuates the difficulty getting to sleep. And then we're now convinced we can't sleep, and that makes things worse. And so we pick up some more maladaptive habits, and pretty soon we have this behavior that we have learned that when I go to bed, it's going to be a disaster. I can't sleep, and so guess what? I can't, because I believe I can't. Okay? So there is, and this is based on now over three decades of research. So these are well-researched ideas that I'm going to present about this. It's called behavioral therapy for insomnia. Excuse me, cognitive, CBT. Cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia. It is generally a short treatment regimen that you can accomplish with a PhD psychologist specifically trained in this. It could also be with, and two of my nurse practitioners right now are training with one of those PhD psychologists to be able to deliver this in our clinic. There are some apps on our phones that actually work pretty well. Arguably, one of the best was developed by the VA. It's cheap, like free. Okay? You have a hard time arguing with free. I've had several of these PhD psychologists say that this particular app is really, really good. It's called Insomnia Coach. So if you look in your app store and you put Insomnia Coach, look for the one that says by the VA. And use that to help learn, number one, cognitive. What is it I am doing? What have I learned over the years that is perpetuating my insomnia problem? Because we all have, including me, and of course I've tried hard to unlearn the maladaptive things and teach people the good habits for sleep. But in my own personal life, I probably have some bad habits that perpetuate problems with sleep. Okay, and I just haven't explored to get rid of them. But it helps you learn these habits and recognize them so you can ditch them and get rid of them. And then the behavioral strategies, there are four or five different well-researched behavioral strategies, all of which will not work for everybody, but one or two of them will work for most. And you find the behavioral strategies that work, you put those into play. So number one, you unlearn bad habits, then you replace them with good habits that result in improvement in ability to get to sleep. Cognitive behavioral therapy is more durable than drugs, and obviously has way fewer side effects than drugs. And if you can get the app for free and it works, well, drugs are not free. They cost you something, even if it's costing your insurance something. They cost somebody something for the drugs, and that's an ongoing treatment that lasts sometimes for people the rest of their lives. So there you go.
Okay, I think of insomnia as you get to bed and you can't go to sleep. What about if you go to sleep for 4 hours and then you wake up and you're awake for 2 hours?
Mm-hmm. So there's insomnia, I go to bed, can't fall asleep, and there's insomnia, I go to bed, I fall asleep easy, I wake up, and then I can't go back to sleep. Now my mind's racing, I can't go back to sleep, okay? Cognitive behavioral still works for that, okay? Sometimes different causes bring that on, but it's still, because what happens is if you start waking up after 4 hours and you know you can't go to sleep, then you immediately have anxiety, I can't go to sleep, which makes your insomnia worse. So cognitive behavioral still works even for that, but I would add to that, there's generally a reason for that awakening after 4 hours. If we can find the reason for that awakening and address that so that the awakening doesn't happen, then sometimes we can make the insomnia go away because it wasn't really insomnia, it was something else going on. Oh, guess what? Same thing with older men, too. Or, yes, indeed.
Our partner gets up every 2 hours, and that wakes you up.
Yep. Yep. I know. And as much as I hate advising it for some patients, I tell them, you know, it's time to have two different bedrooms. Well, that doesn't mean you don't love each other. It's just... Yep. Yep.
Mm-hmm. So it's possible to be in the same room with him because we cruise and you're in the same little cabin.
Mm-hmm.
But I bring some earplugs.
And that's a way to drown out the snoring. My wife and I have learned if we have actually fairly loud white noise in our bedroom, she doesn't hear me, I don't hear her, and we both sleep a lot better. We've never had white noise about a year and a half ago. We decided, let's try white noise. Oh, yeah, we haven't given that up.
That might be something because he didn't ever like having a radio on.
Yeah, the white noise is something nondescript that's not, you know, changing and got all this interesting variation. It's just like rain falling on a roof or something. You can get apps on your phone that have white noise.
I know my own husband uses a meditation app.
Mm-hmm.
When he goes to bed, I always go a little later than he does, give him time to get through it. And when I get there, he's out cold.
And meditation is actually one of those behavioral strategies that they can teach that help people. Along that same line, I was with my wife and her sister and husband. We were staying in a cabin up on the top of the mountain, one of those take my side-by-side and go riding and explore the mountains and the trails. So it was a one-room cabin, and they were on one side and we were on the other. And my brother-in-law has to have a nightlight. But guess what? No, I learned something. This is really, really cool. I don't know when he changed to this, but it was, I don't know, since last season when we went someplace else with him and shared a one-room cabin, he changed to a red nightlight. Oh, my goodness. Oh, my goodness. You need a nightlight? Red. Red nightlights are awesome.
And don't use blue or green.
Do not use blue or green.
I have a Band-Aid over this little flight switch in my bedroom, this little green thing that's like...
Yeah, do not use blue or green. Red. If you wake up and the light is red in the room, you'll go back to sleep a lot easier. Yeah. Red light is the light we should be exposed to in the evening. I wonder if that's where the red light districts came from. I'm sure that those people learned that red light stimulates your interest in resting, relaxing, and getting in bed. And I'm just guessing that's why they use red lights in red light districts. So, yeah, there you go.
Does the red light actually give enough light, like when I get up to go to the restroom? Can I see where I'm going? Does the red light give me enough light for that?
You can use a really bright red light. It's okay. Yeah. And when I woke up, I woke up and it's light in there, but it was red light. Oh, my goodness. I slept so much better. I learned something from that.
Why do you think they have red lights in the old-timey, before digital, in developing photographs? Red light.
Well, but...
Don't be a poop.
But... It's a red light. Our wake centers are not sensitive to red light. They're exquisitely sensitive to blue light. So blue light will wake you up. So if you do have to get up in the night to go to the bathroom, if you have a red nightlight, that's really good, because the minute you flip on the light switch and now you're bombarded by white light from whatever. Yeah, and a really dim nightlight is okay. But honestly, if you can get a red nightlight, it will actually improve your sleep. Will actually improve your sleep, so.
I want to know if there is any recent or new research on restless leg syndrome.
Aha! Yeah, this is awesome. And there is. Hot off the press new. So restless leg syndrome, number one, is a brain iron deficiency syndrome. Brain iron deficiency syndrome. We've known that for a long time. That's not hot off the press. That's not breaking news. We've known that for a long time. Okay? What we haven't known for a long time is why. What is it that causes some people to have deficiency of iron in their brain? We know that about 10% of people who have restless leg syndrome have restless leg syndrome because they have anemia, low iron in their whole body. 10%, that's not very rewarding. Okay, so we've been looking, and I said for a long time that what they found was what they were going to find, and that's what they found. Okay, so the latest information we have about restless leg syndrome is that we now, I'm going to say probably, know what the cause of restless leg syndrome actually is. Okay, still brain iron deficiency, but the substantia nigra, it's a little small mirrored nucleus, one on each side of the brain. A nucleus just means a little clump of brain cells that are specialized to do a specific thing. So it's called the substantia nigra, which in the old language means the black stuff or the black substance. So these old anatomists, when they were dissecting the brain, they said, hey, look, black stuff. And the name stuck. Okay, so the substantia nigra, it is black because when everything works right, your brain works really hard to just pack iron in there as concentrated as it can possibly get it. People who have restless leg syndrome, if their brains are biopsied after death, it's not black, it's gray. I guess not biopsy, but an autopsy after death. It's gray. It's not black. So I guess they'd call it the substantia grease or something. I don't know. But it just simply doesn't have enough iron in it to be black. And what we've now learned is that you get down on the cellular level, our cells are covered. That membrane is covered by all sorts of receptors and pumps and molecules that do various different things. So there's a molecule on the cell membranes of these substantia nigra cells that are iron pumps. They take iron from the bloodstream and pump it in at high concentration into the substantia nigra. People who have restless leg syndrome have a glutamate receptor on that iron pump that doesn't work right. Okay? Keep in mind, half the stuff we think we know about the human body isn't really true. We figure that out over time, which half is which. Okay, but right now, there is a lot of research going into, can we find some sort of pharmaceutical product, some sort of, and you know, everybody gets upset about pharmaceutical, but all of our pharmaceuticals came from plant and animal sources. They came from nature, and then we got involved in it and messed with it and made it better, right, than what nature made it, okay? So they're looking for some sort of agent that we can take into our body, hopefully with very few side effects, that will bind to that glutamate receptor and make that pump work right. It's fascinating that we have also learned, as a result of finding that broken glutamate receptor, the best medication to treat restless leg syndrome, actually class of medicines, are the opioids. Okay? Well, obviously, we don't want to use opioids to treat restless leg syndrome. But the reason why opioids work for restless leg syndrome is because they bind to this glutamate receptor and make the pump work correctly, which is fascinating. We did not know that before. So I'm looking probably for something that looks like an opioid but doesn't have the downside of opioids that would bind to that receptor, not do anything else, not cause constipation, not cause addiction, not cause dependence, not cause any of the rest of the misery that goes along with opioids, that would just simply bind to that receptor, making that pump work right. Now the substantia nigra is full of iron like it's supposed to be, and restless leg syndrome is gone. Boy, I'm going to keep my fingers crossed for that. Glutamate is just a neurotransmitter in the brain. It's a molecule that circulates in the brain and does things by binding to the receptor. It's a cofactor for all sorts of different processes. And in this case, it's a cofactor for getting iron into the substantia nigra. Yep. Good question. I know what they're talking about, and you didn't, and I'm glad you asked the question. People are doing research on that to find something or something else. So something that looks like glutamate or that looks like the opioids, the binding part that will bind to that receptor and make the pump work better. Yeah, I would guess in the next 5 years we'll have something that's not just treating the symptoms of restless leg syndrome, but actually treating the cause.
So I was just at the doctor, and he told me to take an iron blood test, and it came back okay. Is it possible that you can have the blood in your body be different than the blood in the brain as far as testing for iron deficiency?
Yes, 10% have that peripheral low iron. The other 90%, it's low in the substantia nigra, so brain iron deficiency, not bloodstream iron deficiency for 90%.
That's kind of...
Well, you can get a brain biopsy.
My question is, so it doesn't make any difference if you take iron supplements than like a...
So if you have iron deficiency out here in the bloodstream, then at least for, and I don't know the exact percentage, more than 50% of people who have anemia, peripheral iron deficiency, if they take iron or get iron, IV iron infusions, can boost the level of iron in the blood so that now the restless legs is treated by that.
I have a question with regard to the Benadryl, and does it really give you dementia?
Long
term?
Yeah, good question. Benadryl. So it probably doesn't surprise you that Benadryl is the number one used sleep aid in the United States. Why? Because it's cheap, it's over the counter, and it works. It's not a very good sleep agent because it tends to last too long. People tend to have hangover in the morning, and it has a high anticholinergic property to it. Anticholinergics are more likely to cause memory loss, and if you have Alzheimer's, you most definitely should not be on any anticholinergics. In fact, we prescribe cholinergics for people with Alzheimer's, and it turns the clock back about 6 months is all. But 6 months is 6 months. So yeah. Can it cause dementia? I'm going to say maybe, but it certainly causes memory impairment. It has anticholinergic,
so
very strong.
What about allergy, other allergy medications? Are they all
The so-called non-sedating, so Allegra, Claritin, Zizol, Zyrtec, they're all a little bit sedating. The only one that is truly non-sedating is Allegra, and only because it doesn't cross the blood-brain barrier. But because it doesn't cross the blood-brain barrier, it does not cause that anticholinergic effect in the brain, which is what we're trying to avoid. So if you're after an antihistamine that won't cause sedation or that will cause the very least sedation of all, it is the Allegra fexofenadine. So Zizol is much less sedating than Zyrtec, but it still crosses the blood-brain barrier. So that was a great question.
I read a lot about supplements, and I've read that there are people who take melatonin to go to sleep. What is your opinion on that?
Melatonin as a sleep aid, is it any good?
Let me start my answer to that by saying if you lived in Europe, you would only get melatonin on a prescription from a physician. If that tells you anything about what my response is going to be, that would really make my position fairly clear. Melatonin should be regulated by the federal government. It is not a harmless supplement that we should be handing out left and right and selling over the counter. To add to that, there is a company that goes the rounds of the supplement industry, including melatonin and other things. They're an independent testing lab, and about every 5 years they get through the major supplements out there. So they collect supplements from the companies that make a particular supplement, they analyze them all, and then they publish a report. It shows up in the medical literature. So, say about 5 years ago, so they're due to repeat this study coming up shortly, they tested melatonin products, the over-the-counter melatonin products from, and I don't remember the number of producers out there, 2 dozen, 3 dozen, whatever there are. And what they found was really, really scary. They found that the amount of melatonin in over-the-counter melatonin products made by these major manufacturers ranged from 0% of the label to 580% of the label. Now, if that engenders any degree of confidence in you for any of these products, I'm sorry. It tells me I can't, in good faith, recommend over-the-counter melatonin to any of my patients. I'll just say once again, I think it needs to be regulated, and I'm not a regulation guy. I hate regulation. I wish we had less regulation, but melatonin, I think, is hurting more people than it's helping in the over-the-counter industry. So people come into my clinic. I'm taking this melatonin product. It works every time. It's great. I have a hard time arguing. For you, it's working. Hallelujah. I guess you can keep taking it.
Yeah, they're coming to you if it's working.
Well, they're coming for other reasons. You might be coming for sleep apnea or something. So I do recommend melatonin for certain things. So any patient with autism has melatonin deficiency. Now, 100%, there's nothing 100% in medicine, but the research has shown that almost every, especially kids, but even adults who have autism should be on melatonin supplementation. It improves their sleep. Everything about their life gets better when they're on melatonin supplementation. So in that population of patients, I will recommend melatonin, not over-the-counter crap. But there are certain sleep disorders that respond to very low dose melatonin, not insomnia. But there are certain sleep disorders that I will use pharmaceutical grade melatonin that I've found two pharmacies in town that reliably produce good compounded pharmaceutical grade melatonin, and those are the two pharmacies that I use. I've used other ones that some of them have good, some of them don't have good melatonin. But these two are the least expensive and have the very best. That's a good combination, so that's where I go. So, and they only sell it on an order from a physician. But Stapley's at City Center, and then out in Hurricane Family Pharmacy. And the other ones that I've tried, the stuff they did either didn't work or cost twice as much, so that was a good reason for me to switch. So there you go. Melatonin. It's a great question.
What is the best and safest sleep aid you recommend?
Cognitive behavioral therapy. Yeah. Well, all of the pharmaceutical products work at a cost. At a cost, yeah. Yeah.
Yes. How about magnesium and dark chocolate for a sleep aid? I take it like an hour before I go to bed each night, and it seems to work good.
Magnesium does help some people fall asleep easier and sleep better. So I use magnesium for my patients who have muscle cramps at bedtime. It works really, really, really well for muscle cramps at bedtime. I use it myself for the same reason. Since I've started doing that, I rarely have muscle cramps in my calves anymore, so that's been a really good thing. And I have people take it at night because it also helps. Magnesium is an important cofactor in glucose metabolism as well. So if you have diabetes, taking magnesium could potentially be of benefit for diabetes. So,
what if you're not deficient in magnesium? Can you
overdose on? Yes, you can. You can overdose on magnesium. Generally, if you overdose on magnesium, you have diarrhea, and so you're incentivized very quickly. Don't do that. Yeah, you've all taken the magnesium citrate prep for colonoscopy, and that's why everybody loves colonoscopy, because they love the magnesium citrate. It is so pleasant and wonderful. Yeah. Yeah.
And then just to continue, what about, you know, you can buy these herbal preparations like valerian, and it's like sleep now, or, you know, what are these things with a grouping of herbals? I mean, are they?
Well, most of them have melatonin in them, so you already know my answer with regard to that. And adding things to melatonin does not make the melatonin work better. So there are some people who will respond to valerian root. There are some people that will respond to passion flower. There are some people that will respond to hops. Some people that will respond to magnesium and dark chocolate. So when, if my patients come in and tell me I have found this and it works for me, I tell people, well, then keep taking it. That's awesome. I'm glad it's working. Cool. That's great. You might be the only person I know in the whole world for whom that one works, but keep doing it. It's working. Conversely, I tell people, even with a pharmaceutical product, if I recommend something and you try and it doesn't work and you come back a year later and you're still taking it, what the heck? Are you out of your mind? It doesn't work. Don't take it. It doesn't work. But what works for one person may not work for another.
Okay, back to the melatonin. I heard that if you take melatonin, your body will stop producing it.
So let me give you an example of what the body can do using a different thing than melatonin, because we don't know for sure on that one.
Okay.
That's your question. I don't know the answer to that. We don't know if it decreases melatonin production. So back to restless leg syndrome. We used to always recommend the dopamine agonists, ropinirole and pramipexole. That was our first line treatment. But guess what? When you take it, and we've known this in Parkinson's disease for decades, when you take it, it teaches your brain to stop making dopamine. And when your brain stops making dopamine, really bad things will happen to you. Okay? And the worst one in restless leg syndrome is you go back to your doctor and you say, well, that pramipexol kind of stopped working, so I'm taking two now. Will you prescribe two? And the doctor says, well, sure, we'll prescribe two. And then 6 months later, well, you know, two kind of stopped working. I'm taking three, and it works great. Okay, good, I'll prescribe three. And then it's four, and then it's five, and then it's twice a day, and then it's three times a day, and then it's four times a day. And the reason is because your brain no longer produces dopamine, and now you have a condition called augmentation, which is by far and away the most feared complication of restless leg syndrome and dopamine agonist treatment. So the recommendation for restless leg syndrome is no longer dopamine agonists. You only use those if that's the only thing that will work. The recommendation now is either gabapentin or pregabalin, which have very, very low incidence of this augmentation. So anyway, we don't know on melatonin, but we do know on some sleep conditions, and restless legs is the poster child for that. So, and I've had people come in on 16 milligrams of pramipexol, and they have restless legs 24 hours per day that is no longer controlled by anything. It's ugly. It's ugly. So if you're on a dopamine agonist, that's not a disaster. But if you feel like you need to go up on the dose, you got to go a different direction. Don't go up on the dose.
I wonder if you could talk a little bit about sleep apnea.
Okay.
How it's treated and any new treatments.
Okay. So obstructive sleep apnea, I have changed the way I explain to my patients that sleep apnea happens. This is the way it's always been, but I've just changed the way I explain it to people, and then it makes sense what we do with treatment. Okay? So when we inhale, the diaphragm contracts and pulls down. That expands the lungs, creates a vacuum inside of our chest, so negative pressure, and air rushes in from the outside to fill the vacuum. In this part of the airway, okay, from the Adam's apple up to the soft palate, our airway is surrounded by soft tissue, and this is where sleep apnea happens. So the average human in that collapsible part of the airway will generate up to, or down to, -4 centimeters of water pressure. The units don't mean anything, don't worry about that. Okay, so it's a small negative pressure in the airway because we're pulling air from the outside. We need negative pressure inside of our chest, and that is all the way to the tip of our nose. If something happens in the airway that it takes more than -4, more negative pressure than -4, then the likelihood of sleep apnea goes up. So you can imagine this vacuum. Vacuums kind of suck things. And if you got restriction and now you have -10 centimeters of water pressure in this collapsible part of the airway, that it might actually pull it closed. Okay? So that explains why CPAP works. So CPAP is positive airway pressure. Simple math. -10, add +10, 0, airway's open. Okay? In the medical terminology, that's the P-crit. It's the critical closing pressure of the airway. That's always a negative number. And that's the number, if we actually measured it, that a CPAP would be set at, because if we match that P-crit with positive airway pressure, then the airway doesn't collapse anymore and sleep apnea is treated. Okay? So CPAP, we're just wiping out the negative pressure. What causes that restriction is generally soft tissue. Since that part of the airway is surrounded by soft tissue, and I'm sure that you have noticed, like I have, the more years I add on to my age, the more things sag. Dang it. And the less well things move. Darn it. So the older we get, the more likely we are to develop obstructive sleep apnea. Not that we didn't have it before, but that we were able to compensate, overcome, and at some point in the aging process, we just can't overcome that anymore, which is why the older we get, the more likely we are to end up diagnosed with sleep apnea. But we diagnose babies with sleep apnea. We diagnose toddlers with sleep apnea. But the likelihood in a baby or a toddler of sleep apnea is 1% to 2%. The likelihood in this group right here, that includes me, okay? In this group right here, in women is about 30% and in men is 40%. Wow. So you get diagnosed with a sleep study, and that's the majority of what we do in the sleep center, but we treat every type of sleep disorder. But I'd say 90% of what we do is sleep apnea. So you do some sort of test that determines whether or not your airway collapses while you're sleeping. So it's all, well, that's when we sleep, so some type of overnight study. So oh no. Now we love home testing. So whenever possible, we're trying to do home testing. It costs less money, and people are more accepting of that. And then sometimes we have to put people in sleep lab. So did that answer the question about sleep apnea?
Just one more.
Okay. Oh, a CPAP, not a sleep. You're on a CPAP. Yeah. Oh, yeah, the mask is the... Yeah. We don't... Because of COVID, they took away from all of us the opportunity to do a lot of mask. We used to fit people all the time in the clinic. Now it's really on a rare basis that we can do that. The medical equipment companies don't do that. You come in, they say, well, try this one, and give you a box, and you take it home and try it. Because now, if you open the box and break the seal, you own the mask. I know. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. What we tell people, at least what I tell people when they're getting a brand new CPAP, the medical equipment company personnel will tell you that you have 30 days to bring that mask back and exchange it for a different one. And I tell people, no, you have 7 days. Because don't go more than 7 days with a mask you don't like. Because guess what happens if you change in 7 days and then change in 7 days and then change in 7 days? You might get a chance to try 4 different masks. But if you wait till day 29, you're done. You get one. Yeah. So I tell people you need to try, most people need to try at least 2. 3's better. 4 would be, of course, better than 3, right? Because you get a chance to try more masks. And in spite of the fact that the medical equipment companies will whine and moan and carry on about this costs us a lot of money because these masks are expensive, those masks cost them a couple bucks a piece. I know they're selling them for $80, $90, $130, okay. And the manufacturer wants you to try their mask. And if they put a billboard on the freeway, come try our mask, you would not go try their mask, okay? Because that would be very ineffective advertising for them. They've learned the best way to advertise you is get their mask in your house. So that medical equipment company, at the end of that 30 days, any mask that you've tried, they send them back to the manufacturer, and the manufacturer credits them for what those masks cost them. Yeah. They'll deny it because then they've lost their leverage. So just when they complain, if you're in there trying to get a different mask and they're complaining, you just say, yeah, I know, but I've got to try some masks because this is not going to work. And if I can't find one that works, then I'm not going to use the machine. And then it'll get turned back in and you won't get paid. and all of that's true, and they know it. Okay?
I've been diagnosed with sleep apnea, and I've been on a CPAP for quite a while. And I believe when I look at my machine, it tells me how many in the morning, how many events per hour that, and it can be, in my particular case, I have no secrets. I was diagnosed with over 60 events an hour before I went on a CPAP, and now I'm down to 5 or 10. I was also told something with regards to sleep apnea, that it can't possibly kill you.
Oh, no, that's not true. It can.
Some of your people, your nurse practitioners have said that it cannot kill you.
It's unlikely to kill you, yeah, but it certainly can.
I've had 3 or 4 friends much younger than I have been in their 40s and 50s wake up, or obviously not wake up in the morning.
Right, and right.
I was wondering what you thought about. So you've obviously given me the answer that, yes, it can kill you, and I believe it, that should be advertised more because it's a very, you know, I believe an event is where your heart stops. You either stop breathing or your heart.
Well, your heart doesn't stop, but your breathing does.
Yes.
But if your breathing stops and your heart stops, you don't wake up in the morning.
Right.
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 Yeah. Yeah. You could have a stroke. Yeah. Right. Yeah. So I tell my patients that rarely people can die at night because they're not treated with their CPAP. But I've heard the complete opposite told to people that a sleep doctor will tell them, you better wear this machine. If you don't, you're going to die. And I take exception to that because whether you wear that CPAP or not, guess what? People, we're all going to die. Someday, we're all going to die. We're wearing our CPAP. We're not wearing our CPAP. Someday, we're going to die. Okay? And I have no way of predicting whether you're the guy that will die if you don't wear your CPAP. So I tell people, yes, there's a potential. I have had some of my patients die because they were not wearing their CPAP. It's been rare, but I've had it happen. Okay? You could die. Yeah. And we've I'm going to say we don't have really good data to answer the question how many people die because of untreated sleep apnea. What we have is considered epidemiologic data, which is not cause and effect. It is relational. So there are two studies going on that were started in the 80s in the East. One is called the Sleep Heart Health Study. The other one is called the Wisconsin Nurse Cohort. Those two studies have something doggone close to 100,000 patients in them. And if they started in the 80s, you can see where this is going. We now have 4 decades worth of data on these cohorts. Does not establish if you have this, it causes this. What it establishes is, okay, look, in this cohort, we have 10,000 people who have this, and we've followed them for 30 years. And in 30 years, this percentage of people with this condition have had this set of things happen to them at higher frequency than the other people in the cohort that didn't have that, whatever it might be, sleep apnea, heart disease, blood pressure, whatever it might be. So we do know that if you have obstructive sleep apnea and it is left untreated, you are at higher risk for premature death, okay? Blood pressure, heart attack, stroke, congestive heart failure, atrial fibrillation, glaucoma, erectile dysfunction for men, type 2 diabetes, pulmonary hypertension, and the only one of that list that we know sleep apnea causes is pulmonary hypertension, which is the precursor to heart failure. So you could say, well then, Dr. Watkins, don't you know if it causes pulmonary hypertension and that results in heart failure, that untreated sleep apnea causes heart failure. Well, that's circular logic, and don't go there, okay? Because not everybody that gets pulmonary hypertension will end up with heart failure. So we know that there are these conditions. It was actually insurance companies who first found this, which is why in the mid-90s they started paying for CPAP machines. Because if you were diagnosed in 1993 and you decided to get treatment, you paid $4,000 for your CPAP because there was no insurance coverage for this condition. Now every insurance company, almost everyone, covers.
Hi, my husband has a VPAP now. Mm-hmm. He just got it. He had, he would go to the sleep study, and he has sleep apnea, but he got it through the coronavirus. He had pneumonia from the corona, so he had compromised his lungs on the top and bottom lobe. So he's on the VPAP, but he hasn't got it yet, but they told him 26 pressure in and 18 out, but he doesn't need the oxygen. Have you heard of that machine before? I never heard of it.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yep. So VPAP is a brand name. It's a bi-level positive airway pressure device. The brand name that gets used throughout the industry is BiPAP. It's kind of like Kleenex. We all know what a Kleenex is. It's a tissue, right? Not every tissue is a Kleenex because that's a brand name, but we use that interchangeably. So a VPAP is a BiPAP, a bi-level positive airway pressure machine. And that's what it does. It delivers a higher pressure breathing in and a lower pressure breathing out, because when you start getting up into those higher pressures, it can be really impossible to breathe out against that high pressure. So you higher pressure breathing in, cycle down to a lower pressure breathing out, and then cycle back up to a higher pressure breathing in. Right. Right. If we can deliver enough pressure, we can force people to have enough oxygen, right? Yeah.
How about one last question, which is, that's all right. There's that appliance you can put in your mouth that they say.
Yeah, let me go to that, Ann, and talk about, because we didn't actually address, is there anything new? Okay, so the oral appliance. It's interesting that oral appliance therapy was first approved for coverage by Medicare. Over the age of 65, the oral appliance is the least likely treatment to work. I don't know what in the world Medicare was even thinking, that they should approve this for their patient population, because once we get up into 65 and older, we don't respond to these things very well anymore. And yet they approved it. I will say that I have some 80-year-olds that respond very well to oral appliance therapy. That's not very common. That particular patient with really more, it was worse sleep apnea than yours in his early 80s. I told him he had less than a 5% chance. He said, well, 5%, I'll take it. Let's try it and see if it works. And it worked perfectly. And I just shook my head and said, congratulations, well done. Well done. So, works best in younger folks that are not obese, that have mild sleep apnea, and we only expect 70% of people to get a 50% improvement in their sleep apnea. So, if you were treated with one and we got you down to 29, I would tell you, congratulations, you're treated. And you would say, I'm not treated. I know that. But, yeah. Okay, so oral appliance therapy does work best in the younger patient population with mild sleep apnea. And then the one that it should be the burning question for all of you is, what about, I didn't bring my Inspire. I was going to bring an Inspire. That's the burning question. What about Inspire? The nerve stimulator device is about that big. Okay, it's implanted. So it is implanted into the right side of the chest, on top of the ribs, underneath muscle and skin. It has a stimulation wire that is tunneled by the surgeon up underneath the skin, and it's attached to the nerve in the tongue. So the hypoglossal nerve on the far end from the brain, the distal end, is the nerve that makes the tongue do that. Okay? And that's what happens when people come into our clinic and they have this device activated. We have them lay down and they have to leave their mouth a little bit open. And when you get to the stimulation level that works, they'll be laying there and they'll go, I didn't do that. And you know that it's working. And it's always a giggle. I didn't do that because they stuck their tongue out and they didn't mean to. Okay?
Who does that? What type of...
So we have actually three surgeons in town who do that. They're all ear, nose, and throat surgeons, and they all practice together over on Riverside Drive. So, and one of them was really, really proactive with this. He started doing the procedure, and he said, we can do a lot better job than what was approved by the FDA. So he started doing some changing to the procedure, published his results, and now the entire country does it like we do it here. That's kind of cool. I mean, that's the kind of surgeons we have here doing this procedure. So you have to keep in mind, if you decided, hey, I can't stand my CPAP and I want to get this thing, okay? Well, CPAP is the gold standard because 60, 5. 5 is normal, okay? This stimulator device will rarely get anybody to 5, okay? So back to your example, if you stop breathing 60 times per hour and I get you to 29, I'm going to tell you, treated. And you would say, I'm going back to my CPAP. This thing's stupid. But the reason the FDA approved this, a 50% reduction is considered treated. So the FDA said, no, wear your CPAP. We don't need this device. Wait a minute. We have a lot of people in this country can't wear their CPAP machine. They try. They can't. They just can't or won't. Either way, can't wear their CPAP machine. So the FDA said, all right, would we rather have people at 60? Or would we rather have people at 29? 29, it's approved. Okay, and most people will get a little bit better than 50%. And the occasional patient will get all the way down into single digits on the number of times they stop breathing. So is it equivalent to CPAP? Not even close. Is it still good treatment? Yes. I've had patients ask me, so Dr. Watkins, why don't you have one? Well, I stop breathing 20 times per hour. My CPAP works. I don't have any problem tolerating it. When I wear it, I stop breathing 2 or 3 times per hour. Why in the world would I change for something that's only going to get me to 9? I don't want to be at 9. I want to be at 2 to 3. It's working. I'm fine. Not a chance in the world I'm going to have surgery. And there is a 20% failure rate. So you could get the thing implanted, and it could not work, and it doesn't come out if it doesn't work. Stays in.
Is it battery driven or what?
It's battery driven. The estimated life of the battery is 11 years, about like a pacemaker. So I really have a very frank discussion with people when I'm sending them to the surgeon. You have to promise me, if you go get that done, you have to promise me that you understand very clearly. I'm telling you multiple times, 1 in 5 patients won't be treated with this device. You might be that 1 in 5. If you're that 1 in 5, you cannot come back here and be mad. Because you're the 1 in 5. You can't. You can't be mad at the surgeon. You can't be mad at me, because if you do, you're dishonest. You know very clearly going in. Yeah, you're probably going to be the 4 out of 5, but you know what? Somebody has to be the 1 out of 5, and it might be you. So you just, yeah.
Yeah, Mike, I think now it's appropriate.
Well, and I don't know for sure.
Because he doesn't do the operation.
But I'm going to tell you, we'll just use a really wide range, ballpark range. It's somewhere between 30 and 50,000.
Yeah.
And Medicare pays for it. They make you choose. They'll pay for CPAP. They'll pay for CPAP. But once you get the actually, I don't. That's a really good question. I don't know about it on that Inspire. Yeah. They only pay for one treatment. Yeah, they only pay for one treatment.
Well, obviously, if the Inspire clearly fails, they'll pay for the CPAP. And then you go back to the CPAP or whatever.
The surgeon tells me they don't take it out. And you keep in mind, they're not taking the wires out. Taking the wires out would be an incision from here all the way up to here, and you can have this big, ugly, you'd have a big, ugly scar. They can take the stimulator device out, but they said they don't, they've only taken one out for somebody that didn't work, and that was just because the patient pitched such a fit that they took it out. They said taking it out is not a really fun operation, and I said, well, what happens when the battery goes? Well, we take it out and put a new one in. Then why not take it out if it doesn't work? I mean, this seems simple and easy to me, but I'm not the surgeon, so
it's never simple.
And they've made some changes to the device that now it's MRI safe. It used to be the same thing with pacemakers if you got metal in your body, the MRIs become more problematic. If they're ferrous metals, that is a magnet, and it will, that magnet in the MRI will pull metal out of your body, out of your body.
It will hurt.
Out of your body, yes.
Gaping wound.
So, yeah, it's very, very powerful magnet. So.
Well, I don't know about you all, but I think this has been great.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
And I gave you full time because I was about 20 minutes late, and we're 20 minutes late. So that's perfect. That's perfect. I will take that to my staff. Yes, indeed, I will. I will indeed.
Thank you. I'm Reverend Ralph Klingon, pastor of this church.